I've lost count of the number of customers over the years who said to us, you know, when are De Gruyter and Brill going to finally get it together?
And eventually they did. Dutch publisher Brill was bought by its German suitor De Gruyter in 2024. 2 years on, a senior executive at what's now called De Gruyter Brill talks frankly about the pros and cons of two becoming one.
It's damn hard work. Nobody tells you quite how hard it is.
Welcome to Trends in Academic Publishing with me, Patrick Schaefer, and my guest, Ben Ashcroft, Chief Commercial Officer of De Gruyter Brill. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Ben, I wanted to start with a bit of an odd question. Your LinkedIn profile suggests, at least, that you've had a career in sales right from the get-go, which is really unusual. I wondered what it is that has sort of drew you to sales and kept you there.
I think it's the classic publishing story of falling into it, Patrick. I answered an advert from CUP many years ago looking for a German rep, and really the motivation was nothing more than finding a job where I could speak German and travel a bit. And then it just got its hooks into me. Meant that 30 years later, I'm still there.
Yeah, indeed. And talking of that, your profile again shows that you're a real company man. You were at Cambridge for 15 years. You've been at De Gruyter for nearly 13. Seeing people with sort of long tenures within academic publishing is no surprise, but it is for a salesperson. Again, what's kept you in this industry?
I think I'd argue that, you know, sales is sales, but I think I've always tried to say that sales within publishing is an integral part of the whole process and the whole strategy and approach. It's not just a service to the business as it's seen in many other places. And that's certainly how I've tried to practice it. And, you know, both companies, I think, just have a lot that makes them very special. You know, both are full of fantastic people who it's just been an absolute pleasure to work with for many years. And both, you know, I wouldn't be the only person who'd been there for a long time at either company. They both have a record of keeping people for a long time. So there's something in the water in both places, I think.
And I guess when you look at De Gruyter, even before it combined with Brill, it was a kind of complex business. You had several pillars to the business. As the CCO, when you wake up in the morning, what is it that you're selling?
I mean, increasingly since the merger with Brill, we've been selling the idea of the merger. You know, why? What is De Gruyter Brill? Why have we come together? And why is that something that merits people's attention and in the end their investment in our products? Before that, the story of De Gruyter, and in the end, what brought me to De Gruyter was the story of a company that's been around since the 18th century, which was built through the entrepreneurial efforts of one guy, Walter De Gruyter, who brought together diverse other companies and imprints into a publishing house, and then the further development of that from being a very sort of German company into a much more international one in recent years. I like to think sometimes that we've continued what Walter did, in that we have also brought together imprints, you know, products, brands from other companies as part of the process of building the company further. And that's a compelling story and an interesting one.
Clearly, the business has been through, a couple of centuries of change. Things are accelerating, I would argue, these days with AI. Are you seeing your own horizons change? Is that different in a family-owned business?
Yes, it is. I think being family-owned does give you a certain luxury in that, you know, they think long-term. They're looking for the business to remain in their ownership, to develop, but they don't have the pressures of the quarterly shareholder reports, that sort of pressure that you get in a publicly held company. So yes, there's pressure, and rightly so, but on the other hand, you know, we've always been able to be certain about the level of support and the level of investment that we've had from them, and we're very grateful for that. But we also try and make sure that we leverage that in order to think long term, you know, to actually take time to work out what's best for the company long term, and how to develop it responsibly and sustainably.
I'm sure you're familiar with Simon Sinek and the power of why. I wondered if you could explain what's the why of De Gruyter Brill now. What's the sort of driving passion behind the two businesses, the one business?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there are many ways of answering that. I mean, I think the sort of more hard-edged one is really around the commercial necessity or the imperative of how to remain a sustainable business in the environment we're in now. Our competitors are large and getting larger, and they are financially powerful. And being able to hold your own in that market looks a lot different if you're a 150 million euro company than it does if you're a 50 or 80 million euro company. So the combination is just more powerful, more present, at least hopefully, in the market as things get tougher and more competitive. And we also obviously feel the need and the pressure to have a business that has margins that are sustainable and that allow us to invest in many things, but primarily technology, which we're going to need if we're going to remain competitive. So, you know, building a more efficient business thanks to the scale that we had was an important driver of the merger. But
yeah,
if you go beyond those sort of, you know, more hard-edged things, I've lost count of the number of customers over the years who said to us, you know, when are De Gruyter and Brill going to finally get it together? It's a bit like a couple that circles around each other for many years. I think there was a natural cultural fit there. I think, you know, in publishing for the humanities and social sciences, which is mainly what we do, you know, there aren't so many large players out there. You know, when we started going into the conversations with Brill around the merger, I think on both sides we felt pretty quickly that there was just a cultural fit there. There was, you know, we were coming from the same place, despite the fact that there was a German-Dutch side and a Dutch side and all those things. And, you know, that felt right, and still does, to be honest.
Since you mentioned culture, I did have a question around that, actually. It's interesting that in the trends report that we do each year, this year, more than ever, there seems to be this sort of cultural tug of war happening within lots of publishers, where we've had over 50% of publishers identifying their own, and this is identifying their organizations rather than themselves, they've identified their organizations as traditional. And 34%, I think it is, and another 31% identified themselves as entrepreneurial and innovative. And those kind of, I suppose, on that spectrum is quite interesting. You say you've got a kind of similarity towards Brill. Where are those companies on that spectrum? Are you both traditionalists? Are you both innovators?
I think at their hearts, both organizations are fairly traditional. You know, continuity going back to the 17th or 18th century does have an impact. And on the De Gruyter side, being family owned has an impact as well. You know, there is something pervades the organization as a result of that. And, you know, we also, I think both organizations have also tried to leverage that tradition as part of their positioning. So both De Gruyter and Brill digitized their entire archives going back hundreds of years over the last few years, as part of recognizing the role that tradition plays. And I think as a publisher, if a publisher's sort of core USP is the content and the role it's played in guaranteeing the value and the quality of that content, then pointing to the tradition is a very legitimate thing to do, I think, as part of how you present to the market. At the same time, I think that there is pressure to be more entrepreneurial, and I think those tensions do play out within the cultures of both sides of the organization. You know, to a certain extent, when we try to move fast, when we try to do things that are new, you know, it does require some effort. You know, the publishing, especially academic publishing, is a fairly slow-moving business, and in order to really really get things done that are innovative. You do have to move things, and you do occasionally have to break things as well.
Yeah. And interesting, I read a few of your the sort of stated ambitions from the press release when the companies merged. And I wanted just to pick out a few of those things and kind of just, again, dig into those a little bit deeper. One of which, since we're on the topic, was to attract and retain talent. And again, I remember a few years ago with our trend survey asking how frequently publishers were recruiting people from outside of the industry to try and get fresh thinking into that. Again, I see that as kind of true diversity that, that this industry really needs. Is that something that, that De Gruyter is looking into? Are you kind of importing entrepreneurialism?
Yes, I think we are. And I agree with you, by the way. I think the publishing industry, you know, has an urgent need to bring in knowledge and experience from other places. And I'm sure we'll come on to talk about AI. And that is definitely an area where expertise is going to need to be brought in. We have done so. I think, you know, a few years ago at De Gruyter, we insourced our platform, our product platform, having relied on external vendors for a very long time, and that meant we had to bring in knowledge and expertise from outside on the technical side that we hadn't had before. And that's been a very interesting process. You know, sometimes that has been successful. People have come in with knowledge and experience that we haven't had in the business before and have found their niche and have flourished. In other cases, it's been less successful because people have looked around after a little while in academic publishing and said, this is just weird. What am I doing here? because it's a very particular environment. And that, I think, is one of the challenges with, you know, with bringing in people from outside. Another example would be sort of on the business analysis side, for example, you know, where that sort of knowledge is really more and more needed because of the amount of data that we're working with these days.
Yeah.
So we're trying to. I think, you know, there are straightforward barriers to that. Salaries, for example, the sorts of salary levels that are offer in some of these industries is unthinkable for a publisher. But we certainly are trying to do so. Yes.
I mean, I often find that inviting sort of young digital natives into this industry is a challenge because often when they come into it and they see that they're working with sort of early 20th century technologies and kind of antiquated workflows, it's a struggle because, you know, they're not used to that. And I think that's part of the challenge for all publishers, really, to sort of become a more attractive proposition in that way.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And you know, we have done a lot of the things that you would have expected us to do to try and, you know, create the sorts of conditions that people want to come into, whether it's, you know, the way we work with home office or presence in the actual offices, you know, all those sorts of things. We have made some adaptations, but I suspect we've still got a way to go.
And so, Ben, talk to me about scale, which you mentioned earlier. Most independent publishers I speak to would be delighted to have the kind of revenues that De Gruyter were having pre-merger, that, you know, be thrilled with that. But you've stated that it's a very necessary merger to kind of survive and thrive. Why is that? Is that because you're aiming high? Are you looking to kind of get into that kind of leading pack? What's the ambition to scale?
Yeah, we are ambitious, I think. I don't think our ambitions scale to, you know, joining the big five or however many it is. The family wants us to be ambitious for the business, and we want to drive the business forward. I think we feel there is a gap in the market for a, you know, medium-sized to large publisher with a focus on the humanities and social sciences and also one with a European focus. Which is also operating in the sort of Anglo-American sphere internationally, and we have an ambition to be certainly, you know, up there at the forefront in terms of the technological solutions that we offer, whether, you know, applied to the content or applied to the services we provide. When it comes to the sort of relationship we have with our authors, which again we feel is a bit of a USP of the business, and doing all of these things, you know, just costs money, and so a real driver is having a sustainable bottom line. As you know, as a commercial organization, a lot of our competitors are from the not-for-profit or university press sphere. There are pressures, but they're different pressures. Whereas we have to sort of span that gap between often having the type of content that perhaps falls more into the non-profit or university press sphere, but being a commercial company with, you know, with all the prerequisites that that has.
It's interesting because, as you'll know, consolidation and acquisitions are rife in this industry. There's the most illuminating stat, which I'm just going to read. In 2000, the top five publishers held 39% of the market. In 2023, they had 61%, which I won't be surprised to you. I mean, that's kind of getting towards sort of an oligopoly. I wonder whether this merger, was that an effort to sort of stave off an aggressive acquisition of De Gruyter? Were you looking to kind of consolidate before being bought?
No, I think we can pretty much exclude that. The family is very committed to De Gruyter remaining independent. I don't think an acquisition or a sale was on the cards. You know, to the extent it was a defensive maneuver, I think it was about making sure that we had the scale to be able to maintain our independence and be financially viable into the future. But I think if anything, I don't want us to come across too sort of shark-like here, but you know, we have made quite a number of acquisitions over the years ourselves. So I think we would see ourselves more on the acquiring side than on the being acquired side. And part of the motivation was, I think, to make sure that we maintained that position, and also that we, you know, that we made sure that Brill was able to maintain its position as well. Brill has a tremendous brand, a tremendous level of recognition, and an importance in the Netherlands as well as a brand. And it was important to both the Brill side when we were talking to them, and also to De Gruyter, that we made sure that tradition could continue as part of the Dutch publishing tradition.
Do you think, though, that we are heading towards, or maybe we are in a sort of two-tier industry where you've got the large players and then the mission-driven publishers?
Definitely. I think we're already in that. In fact, I would say we're probably in a three-tier industry. I think there's the big players who are way out there beyond everybody else and will probably never be caught. I think there's a midfield where we would see ourselves as well with not that many competitors, actually, and then a large long tail, obviously, of smaller publishers, including many of the mission-driven ones. So the drive to be bigger, to be more sustainable, is about maintaining a position in that middle field and as much as possible a leading position, actually, in that middle field.
Do you see any kind of negative towards that in terms of this kind of diversity of voices that are getting published within academia?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the discussion around the industry and the shape of the industry has become very polarized. I think often from the nonprofit space, what you hear is, you know, there is the mission-driven side of things, and then there is the corporate publisher with its 30% plus, you know, profit margin. And it's a very black and white sort of differentiation between the two. I would argue that there are those two poles. And then there is the commercial publishing sector in the middle with margins that are a lot smaller than the big corporate players, who are seeking to make a healthy, sustainable level of profit, but you know, contribute at the same time to maintaining that diversity, the bibliodiversity, the diversity of offer to authors, which is tremendously important. To, you know, and in our case, through the work that we do distributing smaller publishers, to help the non-profit mission-driven sectors prosper as well. I think we have a role to play there.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, we've spoken to societies, for instance, that have been sort of, they've tried to delegate their work to some of the big five, and they've been turned away because the revenues they would generate aren't big enough for them to sort of come to the table, really. And I suppose that that's probably where that midsection, as you call it, would kind of scoop up those businesses.
Yeah, or I mean, acquire them is one route, of course. You know, there are still a large number of family-run European publishers out there, many of whom unfortunately don't have succession plans in place, who then become, you know, acquisition targets, sounds negative, who can then turn to a publisher like us to make sure that those imprints stay in existence. And then, of course, you know, we also have a part of our business about, which is around publishing services Paradigm, which is dedicated really to ensuring that smaller and not-for-profit publishers have distribution channels to market, for many of whom we've become a really essential revenue stream, actually, thanks to the sales we create for them. So I think we do have a role to play, you know, in several directions there.
So you're 2 years on for the merger,
yes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Roughly. And so we've talked a bit about the kind of ambitions of that. What's the reality like 2 years on? What's been more difficult than you imagined?
It's damn hard work. Nobody tells you quite how hard it is. it's been a very exciting, very rewarding, and very interesting couple of years. But it has also been, it's also been really tough. I mean, there is just a huge amount to do. You end up managing things closely that, as a reasonably senior manager, you haven't had to get hands on with for many, many years.
Yeah. Like what? Give an example.
You're permanently, you know, juggling 1,000 different aspects of things. You know, how will this go down with different parts of the team, of the staff across the different parts of the business? What systems are impacted? What don't you know? What do you know? What unintended consequences might something have? Because, you know, you don't know the business in the way that you knew it before.
Mm-hmm.
Then as I think most managers, you know, change is just tremendously hard work, and should be if you do it right. And you are permanently changing things.
And so when you're looking at that merger, what things aren't you trying to merge? Like, what's the goal? Are you looking for one company?
I think the ambition is that the sort of behind the scenes, we want to be as merged as possible. And we want to really create a new company with an ethos of its own. That comes from the best of what the two companies have, and create an identity for ourselves both internally and externally that is De Gruyter Brill. And that started with the branding that we developed quite early on, because that's a nice sort of haptic thing that people can see and appreciate.
Yeah.
I think the vision is that we have a systems landscape that's combined, that gives us, you know, the efficiencies that we need. We have combined teams which are able to represent the company externally as one, and that those, you know, all those workflows and processes are combined as much as possible. Probably where we will be less one is on the, you know, editorial publishing side, where series will continue pretty much as they are, subject areas will continue pretty much as they are. We're committed to keeping the imprints, certainly the major imprints, in the market. And so that, I think, is where, you know, is where the diversity remains.
And obviously you've talked about the sort of ambition to digitally transform the organizations anyway, improve workflows. Again, our trends report this year was quite startling in that only 8% of publishers said they were well-placed to face the challenges coming down the road for publishers, some of which we'll talk about later. It's not a competition, but in terms of Brill and De Gruyter, which was kind of best placed when you kind of looked at that merger to kind of be a digitally transformed organization, which was ahead?
That's a really difficult question. I'm going to get into trouble however I answer that. I find it difficult to say who was better placed. I think I think there were strengths and weaknesses or opportunities in both organizations. I mean, the step that we made at De Gruyter to have our own in-house content platform, I think probably put us in front as far as that is concerned. You know, to have no more reliance on a third-party vendor for that vital sort of shop window was tremendously important. On the Brill side, you know, they had an enormous amount of upheaval and challenge through the bankruptcy of their distributor Turpin back in 2022, which really meant that they had to, you know, reinvent a lot of their processes and systems in order just to be able to carry on trading. It was a hellish period for all the people there. And curiously enough, that's put them in some ways in a very strong position, because there were just some things that they had to get sorted out as a result. You know, their data, I think, is in much better shape as a result, just out of sheer necessity. So I find it difficult to say kind of who's in a stronger position. I think there are, you know, strengths on both sides, which we're trying to then, you know, get leverage in order to make the whole a bit stronger.
Do you think there's anything lost in the merger? You've gained a lot.
I don't think so as yet. It's a hard question to answer from the position I'm in. I think the proof in the pudding will be in the pudding there, in terms of, you know, what our authors say a couple of years down the line, in terms of, you know, what the staff say. But I, you know, without patting ourselves on the back too much, I think organizationally we're quite pleased with how it's gone, actually. And that ambition to bring the best of both companies together, I think we're making pretty good progress on it.
And I want to come on to AI as a kind of topic in itself, but one of the things that kind of came out in our trends report this year was that for the first time in the 6 years we've been running this report, research integrity was a top three strategic concern for publishers. And my own reading of that is that's because, firstly, there's an insidious element of AI, which is, you know, the paper mills and you only have to look at the sort of Wiley-Hendawi incidents to kind of validate that. And obviously, publishers are using AI to sort of counter that. What's your experience of that at De Gruyter? How are you reacting to kind of research integrity challenges?
It's certainly a top-level concern for us as well. I think it's a complex subject. I think a number of things are contributing to making research integrity into something of an arms race. AI is powering both the paper mills and also some of the measures that have been taken to counteract them. I have to say I'm a little skeptical about how that is going to end, because I think publishers, apart from the big ones, the publishers will always struggle, I think, to keep up in that arms race, simply because the relatively limited technological capabilities that publishers have. Most publishers are not tech companies, even if they have ambitions to become them. I do think a contributory factor to the arms race has been the growth of APC-driven journal models, you know, which created direct incentive to publish more, as if that incentive wasn't there enough, thanks to, you know, publish or perish. And I think one of the things the industry has to think about is whether APC models really are, you know, the future of academic publishing. That I think is where people are going to have to focus themselves, because the arms race is not going to end well.
Are you already considering different models for OA? We had Mirella Roncevic on this podcast a couple of weeks ago. She was talking about the gaps that she identified in her work and Knowledge Unlatched. What are you looking at in terms of that?
Yeah, we're fairly far down the road with that, actually. I mean, as a significant humanities and social sciences publisher, we always had the issue with APC-driven models that often the funding for those subject areas is simply not there to fund APCs. From a fairly early stage, we were aware that we would not be able to rely on APC models to to power our drive to open access. It simply wasn't going to have the impact that that we would need. There really isn't any ideal model right now. We've settled on subscribe to open S2O as being the major model for us on the De Gruyter side. But at the same time, what you know we're saying is a very nuanced message. What we're saying is that for the foreseeable future, that we'll be running a mixed model reality where we have APC journals, Diamond journals, hybrid, as well as S2O. Just recognizing the fact that the landscape is very, very diverse. Funding models are, you know, also complicated, and the availability of funding for, you know, for a lot of the authors that we deal with is simply not there. Quite apart from the fact that, you know, we also want to make these opportunities available to people in countries where, you know, where the money is not available. So there's that aspect to it as well. We're into the fourth year now of our S2O initiative. It is going very well. We haven't yet had to put any journals back behind the paywall, which is terrific. It's been really well supported by the library community, which we're very grateful for. And we're moving forward with putting more and more journals into that model, while still, you know, pursuing opportunities with sponsored or Diamond OA and also, you know, APC models where that's appropriate to the journals.
You obviously are a large books publisher. Do you see open access having a large impact in that sector too?
Yeah, we do. I mean, it's growing. We have, I think, across De Gruyter and Brill, we now have something like 5,000 open access books on the platform. So, I think by most measures, we're the largest open access books publisher. I think the open question there is what the business model is going to be and what the funding model is going to be. One of the reasons we are so preeminent in the area is that in Europe, the availability of funding and sponsorship to make books open access is much better than it is in the States or in the UK. But there doesn't seem to be a model at the moment on the horizon that is really going to allow open access books to be scaled in any really meaningful way, which is a real barrier to progress in that area.
I guess as well, journal production itself is become sort of semi-automated over the years. I suppose it's systemized and it's an industrial business kind of journal production. Books require a bit more handholding. They're spread out over time. There's much more interaction with authors. Therefore, the kind of economics of it are more challenging to move into an OA model.
They are, yeah, and then that largely becomes a question of the efficiency of your processes and workflows and what sort of prices you can accept. I mean, we can do open access books at a comparatively low price point, certainly compared with some of the numbers that I've heard out of the, you know, out of the US, out of the university press world in the US, where, you know, books are much more sort of handcrafted than they are in what you could call a sort of sausage factory, large scale monograph production, which is more efficient. So that's in our favor, but as you say, even then, unless AI makes a radical difference to the cost and the effort in producing a book, it's hard to see how that's going to come down significantly.
I wanted to talk about AI naturally, and digital transformation kind of in parallel with that. Really, I know that you mentioned to me that you were sort of tasked with going out and looking at what AI could deliver to the business, but both sort of at both ends of the balance sheet, if you like, from a revenue point of view, but also from a cost point of view, which I'm keen to talk about. There's a quote that I found that I enjoyed. It's actually from John Hagel III, co-chairman of Deloitte LLP, Center for the Edge Leaders. And I'll just read it out to you. He said, "Most executives are still focused on digital as a way to do more of the same, just more efficiently, quickly, and cost-effectively. I don't see a lot of evidence of fundamentally stepping back and rethinking at a basic level, what business are we really in? And I was curious, Ben, digital transformation, the kind of technological stepping stones that publishing has taken, the market that we're in, there's a lot of shift happening. I'm wondering whether you've taken this opportunity at De Gruyter de Brill to rethink the business that you are in.
That's an interesting and good challenge, and I would have to say, unfortunately, the answer is probably not. I think what we've done in terms of digitalization and AI as well has been really focused on, okay, you know, what can we do to improve the business we are in now. One reason for that is that I think if you think about the potential impacts of AI on publishers and all the risks that it potentially represents to our business, the one thing that you always come back to that in the end is probably, you know, the decisive advantage that we have is that we originate and have control over the high quality content that people still want. You know, very little, I think, has happened in the drive towards digitization and the development of AI that changes that. And in fact, a lot of what's happened confirms the urgent need still for content that is quality assured and reliable and sourced and all those things. And that, I think, in the context of your question, that's both a good thing and a bad thing. So it's a good thing because it gives publishers a raison d'etre, a USP, some hope for the future in a world that is, you know, pretty threatening in some ways, pretty difficult.
Yeah.
But it also, of course, means that in some ways the fundamentals of the business don't change, and maybe compared with other industries, we are just less able to adapt, reinvent ourselves, and become radically different beings. Maybe that you know basic need is not there in some respects. I worry that that's a naive statement, but I do wonder, you know, in its fundamentals, whether publishing can change to that degree.
I suppose what I see in I don't come from this industry. I've you know came to it 6 years ago. The trends reports have given me a window into it, which has been amazing. And talking to people like yourselves has been amazing. But I suppose what I see is that publishers. Correct and proper interest in research integrity and the truth and peer review and kind of excellence in the work that they do has inherently made them traditional businesses and has made them conservative and slow to change because they need to make sure that those things are preserved. And I think what I see is kind of other players in this industry and other technologies coming into it now, attracted by some of the kind of super margins that those top tier make and think, well, I'll take a piece of that. And I suppose, you know, there was something last year, Microsoft came into the business saying they were going to use AI to kind of generate books. There's a company called Spine's going to do it as well. There's all sorts of new players kind of coming in thinking, well, let me grab some of that market share. I think there's also the phenomenon that I'm sure you're aware of, Google Xero, which I find fascinating, this kind of disintermediation of publishing, whereby all your effort, all publishers' effort to go towards creating peer-reviewed, truthful, accurate content will just be swept up by Google Xero and delivered on a plate to researchers. And that your packaging of that content, that the brand that delivers it, won't get the status that it's had since 1749. Is that not a concern?
It is a concern, and I think your challenge back is absolutely justified. We're in the middle of trying to work out what does this really mean to us, and where can we still, you know, find an edge? Where can we compete? I guess one important reason for publishers being somewhat traditional, maybe, is that we do reflect to a large extent, and should do, the attitudes of people who use and consume our content. The way that academics consume and use content, their fundamental needs don't change very fast. Although the tool sets they used in order to interact with content have been changing. You know, there was a Wiley survey recently which you know, said that well over 60% of the researchers they asked are using AI on a daily basis in their work. So that's a massive shift. But then if you dig down below that and you say, well, what are you doing with the content? That hasn't changed. Right. And that is perhaps an important reason for why publishers are the way they are, and also why, you know, publishers' reactions to new technology, why they are what they are in many ways. You know, I think the danger in the answer I gave a minute ago was that it might have come across as a bit complacent. I don't think we feel that way as well at all. I think we are, you know, we are pretty alarmed at what AI could mean for our business. And zero click is one very visible symptom of the sort of risks that we have. You know, our currency is usage. If there is no usage of our content has no commercial value, and then the whole edifice comes crumbling down pretty quickly after that. And there's no doubt that publishers are seeing the impact of zero click on the usage patterns on their platforms. You know, one response to that is to say, well, it very much depends who's using your content. If it's an academic who needs to be able to cite the content, refer to it, and, you know, write a paper based on it, sooner or later they are going to have to interact with the content and not with the AI generated summary. And that is still something I think we have strongly in our favor. The question is how much of our business erodes around the edges of that core use case, and how does that sort of eat away at our relevance over time? So yes, it is a really core concern.
We work with a quite small but very innovative publisher who's always been interested in technology, and I learned from them this year that they started working with sort of national organizations, one of which is the Welsh government, who provide content for their people like commercial farmers and agronomists. And they started working with the publisher that we're working with, not to buy books or articles or PDFs, but they're buying data. And they're literally buying chunks of kind of JSON data that can't be read by humans, but goes into the Welsh government's own LLM and can be accessed by those professionals trying to access that. So it's I think it's a fascinating model. You know, they want that peer-reviewed, accurate content, but they don't need it packaged anymore. They don't need a cover. They don't need, nothing you can show your mum anymore. You know, it's content that someone is going to interpret through a computer, via a computer. It's not a physical thing. And I think that's probably accurate for some topics. Clearly, this is a professional market that it kind of this suits. But I do wonder if that's kind of part of the kind of trend, if you like.
I think it undoubtedly is, and that's something that we are having conversations around. You know, as you implied, I think one of the questions around that is how many subject areas, use cases will that apply to? Certainly the more data-driven ones, certainly the STM areas would seem to be, you know, obvious candidates for that kind of model. And you know, we are having conversations with a range of potential partners who could help us to put that sort of offering together. Very much looking at sectors like banking, life sciences research, vet and human sciences, those sorts of things. And that's potentially a very exciting development.
Just sort of final question, I suppose. In your quest to explore AI and look at where it might benefit the organization at both ends of that spectrum, was there anything surprising that you found? Anything you thought, well, that's an interesting use case? I think there's been so much cynicism about AI. We're in such early phases of it, really, in terms of productization. What have you found in the market that interests you?
I think the real sort of aha moment for me was a round table that we did with some researchers from around Europe, a number of authors of ours, and we asked them to describe their use of AI. And I think, together with my colleagues, I think we were genuinely surprised the extent to which AI was being used in fields that we wouldn't have thought was the case. We had a guy who researches in the area of Middle East studies, who was a daily user of multiple AI tools in ways that we would not have thought about. And I think, in a way that it comes full circle, right? That just illustrates the extent to which publishers, have to realize this, have to cater for it, and have to get with the program in order to remain relevant. Other than that, daily there are you're confronted, if you get the newsletters and read the use cases from around the industry, there are daily things where you go, wow, that's incredibly cool. I think the thing that's probably really going to change, if we take an internal perspective, the thing that's probably really going to mean the biggest amount of change is that the availability of agents within AI applications is going to mean that virtually anybody within the company will be in a position to be able to automate a workflow. That is massively exciting. The extent to which you can empower people to take a problem that exists in their day-to-day and use the tech to get rid of that problem or speed it up, and then move on to do other more interesting things with their time. That really motivates me when it comes to, figuring out how we can implement AI within the organization and what it could mean a little bit further down the track.
Thank you ever so much for joining us today. I'm delighted that the merge is going well. We'd love to hear from you again 2 years further down the line and understand whether any of these innovations are developing. But thanks ever so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Patrick. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to me, Patrick Schaaf, and my guest, Ben Ashcroft, Chief Commercial Officer at De Gruyter Brill. This is the Trends in Academic Publishing podcast, brought to you by Dainta, Next Level Publishing Solutions. If you're interested in what's happening in the industry, you can get a free copy of Dainta's annual survey, also called Trends in Academic Publishing, from our website. There's a link in the show notes below.